I next met with Dr. Denise Yardley, and to begin, we followed up on the last topic with Dr. Albane, management of ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease.
The decisions, I think, in the ER-positive, HER2-negative patients have actually really broadened, and I think they were a group that initially were not embraced in a lot of the clinical trials and development in terms of understanding the pathways in metastatic breast cancer. And so now, again, as our molecular biologists have really unraveled a lot of additional data with regards to endocrine resistance mediated by this estrogen receptor, we saw the development of the Bolero 2 trial with the addition of everolimus now as an approved strategy in patients who have progressed on an AI. And so now when these patients walk into the clinic, I think the first thing I actually do when I have either documented a recurrence in an ER-positive, HER2-negative metastatic patient or have one that walks in de novo is I quickly look for clinical trials because the clinical trial menu now is so robust for these patients. I find it very difficult to treat one off trial if I have a trial and the patient is willing. I think the other thing I do with my ER-positive patients whose disease allows it is I really go after a biopsy. And I think the biopsy is not so much to establish that this is recurrent disease, but to actually start having this molecular profiling. And our own institution actually has a molecular profiling initiative that we get these tumor biopsies and send them off. You can have this commercially done by various companies as well, but to get some of this information on whether they have a PI3 kinase mutation, which is very high probability in the metastatic ER-positive patients, and then see if I have a trial to match. For the patient that, you know, is not a trial candidate or doesn't desire a clinical trial, my practice preference is I do really roll out the everolimus as an approved strategy for these patients who have had this AI exposure. I don't really do the combination of the aromatase inhibitors with fulvestrant. I've looked at that data, and I find it a little conflicting with a negative trial and a positive trial, and the advantage seems small, and the discontinuation rate seemed a bit high. And because I think the science is really in looking at these key growth regulator and resistance pathways, not really combining the hormonal strategies that was so popular actually with the chemotherapies, I just don't see that we get that same mileage.
Can you talk a little bit about your experience, particularly having had so many patients with trials of everolimus with toxicities? I get a lot of questions about the mucositis. I'm kind of curious, first of all, what you think about the pathophysiology of the mucositis.
I've looked into that and spoken with many of the folks about what might be the mediator and in terms of, you know, are there levels measured in the saliva? Is it actually a direct mucosal contact? And, you know, I think there's not a one fit answer for that and exactly how that evolves in patients. And it seems that there's a group of patients that are quite susceptible and a group that just sails through it. And in fact, you know, having participated in Bolero 1 and Bolero 2 and 3, you know, they were all blinded trials. So occasionally, I think the development of certain side effects such as mucositis or diffuse rash, you know, may lend itself to unblinding this blinded trial. But I would have to say I myself was dumbfounded in a patient who subsequently progressed on Bolero 2, and I was screening her for a phase 1 trial in which a prior mTOR inhibitor was prohibited, and so we were able to reach out and unblind her. And I kept saying, you know, no problem. She's going to be a patient for this trial. She had no side effects. She could not have been on the everolimus arm. And in fact, she was. Sailed through it, never dose reduced her, never got a complaint out of her. So I think there's a sort of a dichotomy. My approach, because I think it's very valuable in managing these patients, but I think it takes an extra finessing and having experienced everolimus from some of the other tumor types through our practice. practice in some of our phase one trials, I think, you know, I was probably a little more experienced with managing the side effects where some physicians who may not have as many broad other tumor types in their practice with like the renal cell, where those physicians, I think, manage everolimus day in, day out. I meet with the patients very quickly. I educate them and have the nurse educate them that we really want to know about the development of the toxicities early on. I institute very quickly dose reductions or even dose delays, let the patients recover, and then may drop the dose from 10 to 5 and then do an every other day schedule and then work them back up to see if, because I think it's a valuable treatment if you can get the patient through the initial hurdles of some of the toxicities that are just so different in combination with a hormonal therapy.
Could you maybe talk a little bit more about the typical clinical evolution of mucositis when you see it and how it compares to other kinds of mucositis that an oncologist might see, particularly related to chemo?
So the chemomucositis, I think, is much more broad and encompassing of the entire buccal mucosa and involves it, you know, all parameters in the entire oral cavity and can be throughout the entire GI tract. When we look at everolimus, it's quite distinct, and I always discuss with them whether mucositis, which is our common terminology, and when we look at the CTC criteria, it really is a different entity. It's more of a shallow base, discontinuous ulcers that might appear as opposed to the chemotherapy where it's the diffuse entire oral cavity lining because of the exposure and the toxicities of the drug. So these are much more from everolimus, these discontinuous little shallow-based ulcers, even amenable to topical approaches. And, you know, one of my own patients on the Bolero 2 trial began to lose a little bit of weight. And of course, that was a blinded trial. And I was trying to figure out if this was disease recurrence. And I was re-imaging her and I imaged her extra from the trial. And then I looked in her mouth and I said, do you have any issues, any complaints? And then way back in the base of her tongue on the side was a tiny ulcer that she thought she bit her tongue. And so she didn't relate it, and I didn't think of asking her in that way. It was only until it actually cost her a few pounds of weight because she was changing her diet. And so we held the drug. It immediately healed, and, you know, we were able to reinstitute it. But, you know, that vignette just gives you an appearance that it wasn't anything when I was examining her for her visit that jumped out in her oral cavity. It's very different from the chemotherapy where it's just this general mucosa irritation, redness that's very evident even sometimes with an exudate when you examine the oral cavity.
You know, as you were describing that case, I was kind of flashing because also on the same audio program with you is Dr. Jose Pizalga. And it was one of those times that I wish I had video and it wasn't just audio, because as he was talking about mucositis, he'd be like he was lifting up his lip and he goes, oh, you got to look up under here and you got to look back here. And it was just so really interesting. It sounds, and I know maybe there's been some speculation about it, like more like viral herpetic-like.
No, I think that would be a good analogy. It's definitely very discreet, you know, very focal and not throughout the mucosa. It tends to be very minimal, but one or two in number of these lesions. And that's why I said it does lend itself even to, you know, a Q-tip and putting some analgesic on it, where the entire mucosa sloughing that we see with chemotherapy is more of the swish and to coat everything in the mouth.
And what's the time sequence of when you see it? Is it usually fairly shortly after you started, or can be any time?
It typically is early on. I think it happens within, you know, the first, you know, 28 days. And within that, it's actually even within the first 2 weeks that patients can experience that. I think, you know, by educating patients, and I think that's the most important part is, you know, patients are often our greatest advocates and the greatest advocates of our medications. And, you know, trying to really instill that this is a signal that not that we have to discontinue this effective drug that we've just educated them on, but to try to manage it. And first we have to be sure and have the lesion heal, and then we can reinstitute. So very quickly to put a dose delay and stop until we recover these lesions and then reinstitute.
I just thought about another one. My instant consensuses could be on the question of what exactly would it take to get you to hold everolimus in terms of mucositis, like one small ulcer, or what's it take?
I think, you know, one small ulcer, it depends on how shallow, based in how much discomfort. You know, I think the important part is I look at the big picture for the patient, and that I want to be able to continue the drug. And I know if I'm continuing the drug in the setting of a shallow based ulcer, it's not likely to heal. Now, you could do a dose reduction. I always think it's better for patients that are starting to have symptoms that are getting into these grade 2 lesions to just give them a break from the everolimus, let them continue their aromatase inhibitor, but let this lesion heal and we have a good bet on healing so that we can reinstitute the everolimus and then manage the patients from that. And I think, you know, that helps the patients, because I think patients, you know, it's difficult to take a medication when you're already experiencing some degree of toxicity. I think getting that break, both physically and emotionally, to allow the healing and, you know, allowing the patient to know that you're not giving up on the drug, but that you're allowing the patient to recover from one of the known side effects and then reinstitute the drug, and perhaps at that point with a dose reduction.
And in general, when you reinstitute, let's say at a lower dose, are you able to treat without further mucositis, or does it often come back?
Often, if I do a dose reduction and the patient has healed, able to continue with the therapy. It's actually been a good experience that I've had with instituting that early on for patients that, and I think particularly if you're experiencing mucositis and a significant number of lesions very early on, that it's unlikely that, you know, reinstituting the full dose, that patient's going to be able to continue. I think it'll be a stop, start. And so we go ahead and reduce the dose once they've recovered.
So continuing on in terms of the issue of HER2 negative metastatic disease, I'm curious what your thoughts are. I see you've been involved with a number of trials related to eribulin. You don't see too many chemotherapeutic agents coming on board nowadays, but eribulin is one of them. And there was a much discussed paper presented at San Antonio, a phase 3 study comparing eribulin to capecitabine. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what was looked at there, what was seen, and how you interpreted it.
You know, that trial was comparing eribulin. It was designed as a superiority trial with capecitabine. And for eribulin, this was a much earlier clinical setting than the approval strategy that allowed eribulin to be approved in largely anthracycline taxane, heavily pretreated patients. So this trial was really designed to move it up earlier in the metastatic setting and to really see if there was a superiority with capecitabine, which is a drug that's used often much later in the metastatic setting or in specific cohorts of patients, such as the ER positive. And so I think, you know, it's a large trial in terms of patient numbers and trying to understand where the trial metrics didn't result in a statistically significant benefit in terms of the primary objective of the trials. I think, you know, what we learned is eribulin is clearly active in earlier lines of therapy. The trial population also had a lot of heterogeneity in it. There were HER2 positive patients allowed. And, you know, when you start now going back and trying to see where the signals were, if that population was removed, I think very interestingly, eribulin did appear to have more efficacy in that trial than came out with the HER2 population. And I think also a signal in the triple negative population, which is quite interesting. And when we look at eribulin and some of the triple negative data, there's a lot of preclinical data supporting eribulin with this whole epithelial to mesenchymal transition, which it actually reverses that back. So I think there are many things that we learned, even though the trial didn't meet its primary objective, that we're now trying to channel towards understanding, you know, if there's going to be a molecular target in that group of patients. That wasn't part of that trial, but I think as we're moving forward and trying to understand how to best integrate eribulin in the metastatic patient and even looking forward to perhaps perhaps a neoadjuvant population as well, and being able to capitalize on the tissue in that component, because eribulin has some great preclinical data, and I think a lot of preclinical data on the triple negative population that I think we're trying to embrace in future designs of studies. And looking back at the eribulin capecitabine, I think it's probably one of the last trials that's going to be such a broad, heterogeneic group of metastatic patients. And I think, you know, it's hard to show superiority. It was definitely efficacious and as equal as capecitabine in that way.
So I want to ask you about some of the research you're involved looking at, but just from a practical level, can you talk about how you integrate eribulin outside a trial setting into your practice, how you sequence it, you know, sort of even with relationship to capecitabine?
So our practice has very openly embraced eribulin since its approval, and I think trying to utilize it in more and more ways. Originally, I think we all used it within the specified indications, and you know, we all had patients that we had run through the gamut of all of our treatments, and eribulin was approved in 2010, and those patients were the receivers of eribulin, and they were very much like the patients in the phase 3 trial, where they were very heavily pretreated. And interestingly, I think all of us said, this is an active agent. We were able to stabilize patients, but certainly patients who are heavily pretreated are definitely much more the challenge with any new agent.
It kind of reminds me a little bit, when I first saw the EMBRACE thing, it was a really interesting design in that it was against whatever therapy you wanted to use, but these people were so late line. It kind of, in a weird way, reminds me of the regorafenib trial in colon cancer, same thing. And yet they saw the benefit, it came into practice. But anyhow, so what's the bottom line in terms of how you use it right now?
So now I actually sequence it much higher in the algorithm of metastatic patients. I have to say I have used it in combination with trastuzumab, and there was data, I think Linda Vedat had that at San Antonio. It does combine very well, and that's a group of patients too that I rapidly run through the approved combinations. Now that we have TDM out there, that gives us another card to play, but these patients actually are around therapy after therapy, and so that's been a nice addition. For my HER2 normal patients, I do integrate, and I have eribulin much earlier in the line. I've used it a second line. I'm trying to think if I've had it as a first line. I know we had another eribulin trial with ramucirumab that was a randomized trial, and there's a similar trial with capecitabine, and you know, we've been excited about the data of ramucirumab in the GI tumor, so we're waiting on the data from that trial in combination with ramucirumab, but you know, that was more of a second or third line metastatic setting, and so I have clearly moved it up in the line of therapy. We do have a neoadjuvant trial that we're trying to get some more information now in more of a chemo-naive population in upfront setting, but I think my most interesting is actually looking at eribulin in the patients who've had neoadjuvant therapy with either an anthracycline or taxane-based regimen and have residual disease, and giving it postoperatively in an adjuvant fashion, which, you know, based on its efficacy in an anthracycline and taxane pretreated population, those patients that have residual disease are high risk for relapse, and so that's a thought of where eribulin may show a benefit in that population, and that's an ongoing trial.
So I got to ask you about, I saw this thing about ramucirumab. I was actually at the ASCO GMI meeting when Charlie Fuchs presented that paper in gastric cancer that really surprised me for sure, and I think a lot of people, because that was ramucirumab, an antibody to the VEGF receptor alone as monotherapy, and it had some efficacy. And so just kind of like, whoa, you know, where's that heading? So I see that you're actually looking at breast cancer in combination with eribulin. What do we know about ramucirumab and breast cancer? Do you think it's kind of going to be the same thing as bevacizumab, even though it's quite different?
You know, it is a quite different agent, and having had a lot of trial exposure and off-trial practice with bevacizumab, I definitely still believe there's a group of patients that clearly benefited from bevacizumab. And so when we were approached with ramucirumab as a potential trial for metastatic breast cancer patients, you know, we were very eager to embrace it, and particularly with eribulin as well. And so the both of those two have partnered. This is not a blinded trial. But I think when we look at the experience that we've had for years with bevacizumab in breast cancer, and many who have had that extended to their GI practices as well, ramucirumab really seems to have a little bit less toxicity in terms of the hypertension and some of the other things that, you know, became a little bit cumbersome for a general medical oncologist who then had to dip back into their internal practice bases in terms of managing some of the side effects from bevacizumab. That wasn't as prevalent with the ramucirumab at all. The other issue is, I think, you know, it combined very well with arubulin. We really just did not see any added features of toxicity, and so it made that very seamless. In the first look, or again, I think the interim data was going to be coming out in the next month or two where we get a look at that trial. I think the other trial that's a companion in a way, a little bit different criteria, because the arubulin trial required the anthracycline taxane. And so that was somewhat of a challenge in the metastatic setting because a lot of patients are entering the metastatic setting without an anthracycline exposure. And so, you know, again, that is a changing face, I think, of metastatic breast cancer patients. But keeping true to the FDA approval for arubulin, that was the ramucirumab arubulin trial specifics. The capecitabine trial that has also been completed and actually opened before the arubulin ramucirumab trial and closed after it, as data is also under analysis. And so we'll have ramucirumab in breast cancer in combination with capecitabine as well. And then I think we'll be looking at, you know, the differences in efficacy and the differences if there were any in toxicity. But I think the plan is, if it's positive, to launch into a phase 3 trial.
So we're still not going to have anti-angiogenesis around for a while. Although, I don't know, do you ever use bevacizumab nowadays?
You know, actually I do, and I'm fortunate at the center I'm practicing at is that we still have phase 1 trials, and because of its approval in other tumor types, the phase 1 trials are not always tumor specific. So I always look through that menu, and some of them are, you know, very much the phase 1 trials these days are almost like our bread and butter first line metastatic. So we've had one in combination with taxane bevacizumab, which, you know, was something I practiced and prescribed for patients. And they combine them with various other biologic agents, whether it's an mTOR inhibitor or a PI3 kinase. And I do roll patients on it. It's interesting, two of the more recent patients that have come off one of these clinical trials with a taxane bevacizumab backbone with a biologic agent developed disease progression. And as has been alluded to, sometimes those progressions can be very significant in metastatic breast cancer patients. And whether it's a withdrawal of that bevacizumab or releasing that hold on angiogenesis, I have been actually able to, in select patients, get approval. And I have one right now that just rolled onto the capecitabine bevacizumab, which is still on the NCCN guidelines through her insurance. But I think that that's a healthcare provider case-by-case basis.
Can you describe the patient type that you most likely would use bevacizumab in?
You know, I guess there are two populations. We had a trial in the ER-positive patient group, and there's certainly some key cell signaling overlapping in the pathways with angiogenesis and hormone-driven tumors. So I know it didn't have that approval, but I still think there's interest in that combination. The other is our triple negative patients. And I think the signal from the ribbon trials and when we did the subset analysis seems to still show that these tumors, or a group of these tumors, triple negative themselves are such a heterogeneic group. So a subset within that group that truly has the angiogenesis pathway as a mediator of their progression and really overexpressed or really the key player that, you know, I still think of an inhibitor of angiogenesis like bevacizumab or even like ramucirumab when you think that wasn't a triple negative but an all comers, but it'll be interesting to see them pull out that subgroup in their analysis if they're designed to do that. Because That has a body of data that still supports it. And I think if you step back and look from the trials that have reported data, the signal is still there in that group. So that's definitely a group that when I see come in as a metastatic patient and I'm looking for a trial, that I quickly look in our phase one menus to see if there's some angiogenesis component in combination with a chemotherapy that would be applicable to that particular patient and their disease.
It's a really interesting thought, though, about the idea of, you know, just wanting to get the control arm at least, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One final question, and this one's about metastatic HER2-positive disease. I know you're in the camp with virtually every breast cancer investigator nowadays advocating the so-called Cleopatra approach of taxane, pertuzumab, and trastuzumab as first-line treatment. But I'm curious how you would approach an older patient, maybe 70, 75 years old, a bit frail in this situation and asymptomatic from their metastatic disease.
You know, I guess if it's a truly asymptomatic patient, but I think when I look at the taxanes, you know, I may change the schedule and give a small amount for those patients. And, you know, particularly I think nab-paclitaxel may be a good option for those patients with a lesser requirement of pre-meds and maybe lesser neuropathy. But I typically would utilize a taxane in just a much smaller dose just to get some chemo, depending on where the location and the burden of the disease. And then I'm rapid to discontinue the chemotherapy and continue my two biologics with trastuzumab and pertuzumab in those patients. But, you know, I think that to me may also be a perfect setting of where TDM may have a role in those patients as well, and very, very little toxicity. And, you know, that's certainly a place that I would struggle with the burdens of three infusions for a patient if I, you know, look at my taxane, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, or this quick TDM single infusion for a patient, and if I get the same mileage out of it and ultimately less toxicity or equivalent toxicity, that may still be where my focus might be for that lady coming on to her first HER2 therapy.
You mentioned TDM1, and I know that you and Sarah Cannon were involved with this agent from the beginning. What's the longest time you've had a patient on this agent?
Oh my goodness, mine is at least, I think, going on 3 years.
Wow.
I mean, it's interesting. The trials have closed and they've rolled on to a rollover trial. Because there was no more data to be gathered, they have continued to do very, very well. And I know my partner, Dr. Burris, has a patient. He and I are sort of neck and neck with the original phase one trials. And then we rolled out a series looking at cardiac. We have a trial now that I think is very interesting for patients with abnormal liver function tests and TDM. So all of the trials to date, you know, have very rigid organ functioning criteria, but as we embrace the HER2 positive metastatic patients and having such a proclivity for visceral disease, a lot of patients were excluded that had some degree of perturbations in their liver function tests. And so this trial is actually seeking those patients. So if you have normal liver function tests, you're not a candidate for this trial. And having had a patient recently that I screened for this trial and was able to enroll, who really was bearing the burden of disease. This was a de novo stage 4 patient that was really struggling and had elevated transaminases and a slight elevation to the bilirubin, not an ideal candidate for any trial, was a candidate for this particular phase 1 trial with TDM in abnormal liver function tests. And she's doing fabulous now. I mean, it really, you know, was effective. And I think as clinicians, we're looking now for the less than ideal HER2 positive study patient that's walking into our office that may have a higher burden of disease and reflect higher organ dysfunction. So it's nice now to see some of the trials address that.
Before, you were talking about nab-paclitaxel, so I've got to ask you about that because it's always a controversial topic. I'm curious, in what situations, if any, right now you use nab-paclitaxel as opposed to paclitaxel?
So I utilize nab-paclitaxel, particularly in a patient. You know, I think we're a little bit limited into our healthcare provider's approval for nab-paclitaxel. So most of them deem that patients have had a taxane or taxane combination in the metastatic setting. And often for me, it's a peer-to-peer if it's outside of that setting. So a particular patient I can think of who was actually an adjuvant patient who had had a prior history of a leukemia and had seen, and it was a lymphoid leukemia that had a lot of prior neuropathy and was a diabetic. And so, you know, I was able to immediately start that patient on nab-paclitaxel because she'd seen anthracyclines in the past as well. So that wasn't a good option for her. And she had that as her adjuvant therapy. In the metastatic setting, again, you know, when we look at the ability of the patients to continue on taxane-based therapy, particularly in the HER2-targeted population, but even outside of that, because it's such an active agent, when I start getting a hint of neuropathy for the patients or if there's an issue with the steroids, which is very prevalent in metastatic breast cancer patients, then again, I think nab-paclitaxel is an ideal agent. I do think the toxicity is quite different from solvent-based taxanes, and I certainly would embrace it for more patients other than the stipulations that are outlined in its approval strategy.